Hi, and welcome to Revision Media. I'm Paul Stevenson, and I will be with you here through for the next hour. That's through till 11 p.m. here in London, England, where I am. And what's that? Five till 6 p.m. Eastern time. Welcome to the show, wherever you are around the world, and I hope you've had a great week. I'll get straight into it. We've had a lot of talk over here about this royal family division and controversy with Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And of course, when she got married, there's a real loving in this country with all the progressives and the liberals loving everything about Meghan Markle, because she's, well, because she's mixed race, she's got some black blood in her, so of course she has to be good. We don't need to look at her character or anything about the woman, whether she's been successful, whether she's got any integrity or anything good about her. The fact is she's got black blood in her, so that's wonderful. She is part of the, whether she liked it or not, but she has been anyway, and she always was, I think. A priestess for the religion of political correctness and cultural Marxism. So she can do no wrong. And anybody who's criticized her in this recent, well, it's been going on for a while, though. Anyone who criticizes her is generally racist. Any acceptance of her in the initial stage and then changing minds about her is literally just Britain showing its true racist colors after a period of time, rather than the country, notwithstanding the progressive congregation and contributors to the religion, who will support her no matter what. Others have actually just not liked the girl because of her attitude. She has a bad attitude. Piers Morgan has described her as a ruthless social climber. She doesn't enjoy, let's say, the duties involved in being a member of the royal family. I mean, the temerity for some nobody who, if you look at her career, and who's a complete nobody, wasn't particularly successful. It's not like it's, I don't know, Nicole Kidman marrying into the royal family. This girl was a C-list celebrity, and somehow convinced Prince Harry to marry her, or what was going on there, I don't know, whether they deliberately planned to do it just as a virtue-signaling bone to throw to the ravenous dogs of political correctness to keep the royal family relevant, whatever the reason. This girl just managed to find herself married to one of the most famous and eligible bachelors, and one of the richest, certainly one of, a member of one of the richest families in the world, and is now causing problems because, from what I understand of it, largely because I've ignored this, but it's just been everywhere and I've checked it out, it's because of her, you know, whinging essentially and complaining about media intrusion and commitments and everything else. As I say, ironic considering the girl is a nobody, and the only reason that anybody knows of her or ever heard of her is because she married into that royal family, which she's now rejecting. But she is probably acutely aware that she's largely got what she needs out of it now anyway. She has a child with Prince Harry. She's been a member of it, so she's set up for life. She could be doing interviews for the rest of her life about what it was like being a royal or being married to Prince Harry. She could have divorced him after a week and the train would have been true, probably. But I listened to an interview on talk radio over here, which would be, well, you know, considered a slightly more right wing. Certainly they wouldn't dare touch the sort of topic. Well, they would touch the topics, but they wouldn't dare be as so bold as we are in the likes of these shows when it comes to immigration and things like that, or the, you know, race realism or jury or anything. These sorts of things never get discussed, even on the so-called, you know, more right wing or more edgy news shows. They are still largely, I would say, controlled to an extent anyway, or lacking, you know, certainly, well, lacking testicular fortitude, let's say, on the whole, because I do believe a lot of these people are aware of some of the things that we would talk on shows like this and would keep their views to themselves for various different reasons rather than being outright forthright about them. But anyway, talk radio would be one of the better shows. They would agree. I would agree with them on most things, even if I would go a bit further on most of them. And they interviewed Brendan O'Neill, similar kind of a guy from Spike, online or spiked online as SPIKED, Brendan O'Neill. And if you, the name would suggest he's Irish. He's, you know, he's, but he's brought up and born over here in England. But I like Brendan O'Neill. I think, you know, again, I mean, I've always said, you know, these people that we would over the last few years have called alt-right figures, who are basically, you know, really affirm civic nationalism and never talk about the Jewish thing, and not only don't talk about the Jewish thing, but condemn us who do, and start behaving like the far left towards them, towards us, is punching right. You know, I've never, you know, been hostile to these types of people, because I look at what I agree with them on, and I might go a bit further, I might add in the Jewish facts into the equation as well. And I say as well, because, I mean, you know, you can get accused of, you know, you can get disingenuous, pejorative hyperbole from some of these kind of commentators. I once heard one guy refer to the Jewish thing as referring to us who talk about it as, oh, if there was a, you know, if there was a crash on the motorway, if there, you know, like an accident pile up in the motorway, it would be a Jew's fault. That is a very disingenuous and pejorative, hyperbolic approach to suggesting that those of us who talk about Jews are obsessed, which we could, of course, say about them when it comes to Muslims. But this is not the case. This is a way for them to try and wriggle out of a corner when you present them with facts about Jews. And it's not appreciated when they do, because I don't think any of us who talk about that particular Jewish issue do the same punching as they do. But anyway, this guy is, you know, these are good topics. And these are important themes and topics. I did commentate a lot on them in the last show, so I'm just going to play them through without so much commentary. And I think, you know, the listeners here will enjoy it as well. And as I say, I'll keep my commentary to a minimum on it, just so I can get through it.
To be able to watch and listen to what they're about to be talking about.
Absolutely. I think it's going to be, whatever happens as a consequence of this, is going to be really interesting.
It really is, yeah.
I think it's a real sign of the times. The whole thing is a sign of the times. You have this, the Harry and Meghan phenomenon, yeah, particularly led by Meghan herself, I think, where they want to break out, do their own thing, become more corporatist, more globalist,
yeah,
more narcissistic, yeah, more PC, more woke. And then you have the traditionalist royal family elements represented by the Queen saying, you know, not so fast.
Yeah.
Hold on. There are traditions. There are rules. There are duties that you, right, have to adhere to. So it's actually a very...
What they, you know, you guys in America don't have a royal family, but we do. And even though I'm not a big royal, and we'll not get into, you know, all the other stuff about, you know, like some of the more crazy stuff that people get onto about royals being reptilians and other stuff about the royal family. We know that the royal family are obviously a part of this, you know, global satanic criminal syndicate, but it still does represent a clash of values and attitudes of what of tradition in this country and what it means to be British. I mean, when you think about Britishness, you think of the Queen. People come here, they visit the, you know, they visit the Buckingham Palace, etc., etc. And you get someone like Meghan Markle coming in here, some black or mixed race little upstart, as Piers Morgan called her, a ruthless social climber, coming in with just complete contempt and disregard for the institution of the royal family, the traditions of the country, and has ultimately been a huge offence to a lot of people in this country. This country is very pro-royal. Well, real people are, not these yapping mouthpieces in our parliament, these so-called leftist, so-called progressive, whinging politicians, media figures, celebrities. Well, you could pick any number of them which would epitomize this, but Hugh Grant, I saw on our news the other day, or on some program, you know, he really does epitomize this kind of celebrity entitlement and, you know, complaining all the time, this liberal, far left attitude that Brendan O'Neill here gets on about.
Symbolic 21st century clash, I, yes, think, between the woke side and the traditional side.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because people keep saying to me, well, it's not really a constitutional crisis, which is true, because Harry's not close enough to the throne,
yeah,
for it to be a constitutional problem. However, I don't think it's right to play down the constitutional effect of it, because we could be seeing the beginning of the end of what is the traditional royal family.
I think it's incredibly serious. I say this as someone actually who has very Republican tendencies. I've never been a very big fan of the monarchy, but at the same time, I think what Harry and Meghan are proposing is in some ways worse, because it's this retreat from responsibility and this sense that, you know, why on earth should we have any constraints in our lives at all? Why should we have the constraint of duty? Why should we have the constraint of family loyalty? Why shouldn't we just do whatever the hell we want to do? So it actually speaks very well to that kind of narcissistic moment, and this new generation, particularly the millennial generation, who think that everything should be about the self, the cult of the self, the celebration of the self. And I
that hits the nail on the head. The vulgarity and the unashamed celebration of the self, to the point that in many cases these days, if you don't celebrate the self and are not utterly self-absorbed, that people think there's something wrong with you.
I really think Meghan in particular and Harry as well.
You know, you need to get your self-esteem up a little bit more.
Reflect that culture particularly well, whereas the Queen reflects entirely the opposite culture, which is the one of self-sacrifice, self-negation. You subsume yourself into a tradition, duty, history.
Yeah.
And so...
Oh, it hasn't taken me long to get into a potentially ranting moment. He talked about the Queen, you know, being, you know, stoicism and self-denying and stuff. And by the way, you know, you might not think it, but this is actually what Christianity and the scriptures promotes. But when you look at the prosperity gospel, we are king's kids, so we must live like kings, and king's kids get the best of things. Unfortunately, they don't tell you that Jesus was kind of a different kind of a king. You know, he wasn't exactly like the sort of kings that we would normally think of. And we get occult esoteric philosophies which have this utterly, in my opinion, shameful preoccupation to the point of obsession with the self, the cult of self, self on steroids. I mean, man has always been a self-centered creature in many ways. But there was always, it was always sort of largely something that you would see yourself as, you know, not wanting to be seen that way, or not wanting to be self-centered. But a lot of the modern philosophies and ideas which have their roots in occult witchcraft sort of type stuff, both outside the church, but I think it's just, it should be intolerable within the church, because it just is complete opposite of church. I mean, of Christianity, and when you, in any of my experience, whenever you talk to Christians about this issue and other issues, it's not like they, you know, of course, the esoteric philosophy, they're all about growth and change. Ironically, they seem to lose their appetite for growth and change when you challenge them. The opportunity that they could maybe take on board, you know, some new information and maybe rethink their thinking or reshape their thinking, and actually embrace some real growth and change when the opportunity is there. Ironically, you know, you would need a digger to dig these people out of their positions. They dig in so seriously. And, you know, far from being people who embrace growth and change, and they're always talking about learning. Relationships to these people are like learning. It's like they don't really care if they work. If they learn something from everyone that they, you know, treat like shit for 8 months, all the better. It's like this kind of reincarnation type idea that they bring to relationships, where each relationship will, you know, cause you to learn and learn and learn, I suppose, and you grow and learn with each relationship until you eventually, I suppose, reach this kind of utopia of self actualization, of course leaving a trail of destruction and destruction in your wake, and you know, and damage in your wake to the people you've been having relationships with. But the point is, you know, in my experience, when I've pointed out to people in the church about particularly these types of self-focused doctrines and the occult generally. Now, this does not apply, of course, to people who are not Christians. If they're not Christians, they're consistent with not adhering to Christianity. But my experience in the church has been, you know, oh, that's very judgmental. It's very, you're too judgy. You know, that is the greatest heresy of a lot of you know, of a lot of the occult esoteric ideas, and a lot of it's in the type of mindset and attitudes that he's talking about today as well, where you just, you know, no limits on yourself, and anybody who tries to curb your attitudes or causes you to have a rethink about your the way you behave, you know, is met with hostility, and bad behavior is affirmed, and anybody who criticizes bad behavior is judgmental, and, you know, whatever they can throw at you, they will. This interview actually talks a bit about that. It's kind of ups down and downs up now, the way this clash of cultures and tradition versus this Meghan Markle and that he's talking about. But just in the church, you know, you will be met with, you know, people who like to go to church, I suppose, because they don't want to go to hell. That's the only thing I can think of, because it's about the only thing that I think that seems to motivate them, or maybe that they've got some pals in there or whatever. That's just a habit or something. Regardless of what the Bible teaches about hell, most of these people couldn't tell you, of course, because they don't read the Bible. But when you do actually inform them about, you know, about, well, you know, it's not really a Christian doctrine, the idea of the prosperity gospel, and, you know, Joel Osteen may have had a bad childhood, apparently, and she may be very emotional, and you may really like her, but she's teaching, or not Joel Osteen, he's the same, but even worse is Joyce Meyer, which really it does appeal to. A lot of these kind of deceptions and heresies which are in the church, but outside of the church as well, this political spectrum, a lot of movements are led up by women who are much more emotional in their nature and are much more easily deceived, in my view, even as you take it as symbolic. And I don't mean this as some hatred towards women. Satan did wait for Adam to be out of the way before he approached Eve and got the ball rolling. And when you tell people about it, or if I've talked to women about it, far from wanting to embrace the opportunity for growth and change, it's, you know, you're judgmental, you're very heavy, you're not like Jesus. I love that one. That Jesus wouldn't be like that. And they would know, of course. And I'm like, listen, don't blame me. These are things that Jesus said. Take it up with him. Now, once you get to that stage and you've pointed out scriptures that Jesus actually might sound a bit more judgmental and a bit more heavy than they were previously led to believe, what's likely to follow then is the questioning and or rejection of those scriptures where Jesus is a bit more serious or a bit more how they don't like. They start, you know, questioning those scriptures' authenticity and, you know, and subsequent truth and authority. But if you're thinking clearly and coherently, then the next logical step in this process is then, why would you believe these scriptures over here to be inspired from God and true and have authority any more than these ones over here that you don't and you reject? On what basis and criteria do you do that? I mean, you might want to, and it might be convenient for you to do so, to pick and choose which scriptures you know you accept and believe to be true or not, you know, based on your own personal preference or which make you feel good or whatever. But you simply cannot have a situation where you accept and or reject scriptures and their veracity on such a basis, you know, and or where they line up with early 21st century secular cosmology and values, or the teaching of your local church. Sadly, there's little difference between the two of them these days, or indeed any other in vogue belief system of the day. A big one is the New Age kind of movement and that whole esoteric occult thinking, for example, with its greatest heresy of being, well, it's probably its only heresy, being judgmental. You know, and they too, like the modern church, they've got their own very scripturally selective and convenient version of Jesus to fit. It's a non-judgmental Jesus. He has his little sandals on there, and he likes to, you know, be nice to people all the time and give little nice little speeches, and, you know, he's got a long beard and stuff, and he's all good. And, you know, they are the same scriptures. You know, the ones that you reject and the ones that you say are okay, they're from the same scriptures. It's the same book. It might only be two passages apart where Jesus says some that they like and he says some that they don't. I'm totally digressing here. But anyway, it's a philosophical point. It's a point of epistemology. And it applies outside of the church as well. It really applies with people who are apparent truth seekers. So, you know, why do you accept these scriptures over here to be true and these ones over here not to be true? Obviously, if you're thinking clearly, there is no good, coherent and logical reason and basis to do so. If you're thinking clearly and coherently and consistently, then the unavoidable and obvious implication and the next logical step in this process is to ask the obvious rhetorical question, why believe any of the scriptures? The reality is you don't have any good reason or logical reason to believe any of the scriptures and have ultimately rejected the authority and truthfulness of the scriptures when you start picking and choosing. When you say, we believe this to be true, but not that to be true. As I said, well, what makes this true and that's not true? By you saying you don't believe this to be true, you are disqualifying the Bible as authoritative in your mind. You can't then go on or pick other scriptures to be true based on your own personal preference or the other conditions that I mentioned in the various different worldviews today. And once you establish that, then you have to ask yourself, why then do you profess to be a Christian? If you're consistent and you don't believe the scriptures are the word of God, I mean, you could go along and be a liberal Christian, which is an oxymoron because they do exactly that. So no one really takes them seriously. I mean, they can think they're Christians all day long, but what, you know, it doesn't make them a Christian. So, you know, and then you ask, why go to the effort of going to the church every Sunday? The point of this is not just the Christian point. It's really a wider point about epistemology and about people and their thinking. I mean, once you've established that, you have to say, why do you profess to be a Christian? Why do you make the effort to go to a church every Sunday? Get up, get ready, put your best clothes on, maybe travel 3 or 4 miles to that church. You're making some effort there. Why bother? There's as little basis for you to do that based on the logical or, in quotes, breakdown that I've just portrayed here as there is for you to go to a mosque every Sunday. It's amazing, really, you know, the time and effort people do spend thinking and doing things which they haven't really questioned and explored as to why they bother to do so. I mean, the reality is, I mean, it's pretty simple that your beliefs inform your behavior, or at least inform what you aim to achieve from your behavior. But the reality is people just aren't consistent. And I think part of the reason I brought that up is because this article does point out a lot of this thing that I'm talking about here does point out inconsistencies as well. But the reality is Christians are Christians and first become Christians. And the reason churches were ever existed in the first place is because of the scriptures and their authority and truth. And, you know, which is recorded and presented in them. And that's the reason some people are Christians and some people are not, because they don't believe or profess to believe. But, you know, as I say, that is the difference. That is the reason some people are and some people are not Christians, or why some people, you know, and why some people don't profess to be Christians, because they don't believe the scriptures to be true. The sad thing and the thing that irritates me is not that people don't believe, they might come to believe, is that people professing to believe, pretending to, or thinking they're Christians, and yet behave and embrace, and the church allows them to, and promotes it in many ways, embraces ideas which are not Christian. It's literally like being, I don't know, being into jazz music, and you go to a club on a Thursday night to listen to jazz music, and there's loads of people playing classical music. You're like, I came here to listen to jazz, not classical music, or the other way around. And I'm completely digressing here, but it's the inconsistency that annoys me, because if people think, you know, if you say to them, listen, oh, that's what it was. We're on to this point of, you know, self-denial and self-sacrifice as against this self-promotion. This self-promotion stuff is everywhere in the church, and it makes people feel good. It doesn't make it true. And if you're a Christian, it doesn't make it even remotely. It's not that it's kind of slightly off Christian doctrine. It's the opposite of Christian doctrine. And yet it is prevalent in what people call churches. Now, God doesn't recognize these as churches, I can tell you that much. The Holy Spirit is not in those buildings. Doesn't matter how often Joel Osteen tries to tell you that your little esoteric philosophies and your little extra intuitions are the same thing as the Holy Spirit. They are not the same thing. It doesn't matter how much lies and deception goes on, you're not deceiving the Holy Spirit. He's not in that building. He's not in there, in those churches. The idea of self-promotion, and to the point that it's like narcissism and self-focus on steroids, is in the church, is an abomination. It's a total heresy, and no one in the church calls it out. So when you point out, because apparently they still love Jesus, you see, because they've got this wishy-washy, limp-wristed version of Jesus that doesn't have any conditions to being a Christian. And when you point out that Jesus isn't like that, and they have to acknowledge that the scriptures say that, then they have to question the veracity and the authority of the scriptures. And once they do that, they are questioning the whole basis of the existence of Christianity in the first place, and why Christians ever were Christians, because you cannot pick some scriptures to be true and scriptures on the following page or the next gospel or the next speech or the next sermon Jesus gives to be true because you like that, how that sounds. It doesn't work like that. And once you agree in your mind and have taken the position that these scriptures aren't true, you have then brought into question and essentially eradicated any authority that the scriptures had, in which case you cannot have any claim to be a Christian. Because that's why we believe. That's why we're Christians. And people should acknowledge that, and they should be challenged on that. And then they can be at least consistent, and they can save themselves some time and do something else on a Sunday morning. I mean, it really does amaze me how little people do in the realm of thinking. I may as well literally go to a mosque or a Hindu temple for all the reason that's actually motivating me in the same way as these people go to a church. Anyway, let's play the rest of this. But it's an important point, this whole cult of self. And it's not just in the wider culture. It's in the church, too, where you would least expect it when you have doctrine after doctrine that Jesus spoke about denying yourself, taking up your cross, putting other people first, etc., etc. This is diametrically opposed to modern day philosophies and doctrines, a lot of them which do have roots in the esoteric and the ancient mystery schools and the occult. But even those, I think, have been sort of amplified and distorted somewhat in our modern day to cause this self-focus, which could be argued in a good, healthy way, into just utter, you know, narcissism, really.
Between the Queen versus Meghan Markle, within that clash, I think we're really seeing a real tussle of the values of
our... Oh, absolutely. And you wrote a great piece in The Spectator, which piqued my interest, in which you talked about people who are the somewheres versus the sort of nowheres.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about that as we were preparing to do this show, because, you know, as you say, the Queen and Meghan Markle, you can tell by who's supporting whom, how it kind of splits in society, like everything almost seems to do now. And all the same people who probably wanted to remain in the European Union, for example, are all kind of on Meghan Markle's side, saying, well, now you can see what power looks like, because they're now suggesting that Meghan Markle has the power and the Queen doesn't. Well, I don't think that's true.
Yeah, I think absolutely right. And the point I made in my piece is that the people who hate Brexit love Mexit. And that's because Mexit, you know, the removal of Harry and Meghan from the responsibility and tradition, is entirely in keeping with the chattering class view.
I mean, it's staggering what Marx couldn't achieve through, well, I shouldn't say couldn't. It certainly in the West up until this point, he couldn't achieve with traditional basic communism. And Marxism has certainly worked in a cultural way. They didn't just say, well, that didn't work. They have applied it very successfully, not to the point where they're getting all their own way, thankfully, but it's been more successful in the West than traditional communism. It really is this hatred of the established order, and hatred is the word for all the irony that they call the rest of us haters. I mean, these people are so full of hatred. Anyway, I want to get through this because it's a good little interview. And again, we've only got 25 minutes left because I'm talking so much. But then it is my radio show, so.
And this view that, you know, the nation is out of date and
racist.
And
which
racist.
I find quite actually insulting as a citizen of this country. You know, I'm not racist. I don't know anyone who is racist. There are people who are racist in the country, but it is not a racist country.
I think you've really hit on the most important part of this whole discussion, which is this notion that any criticism of Meghan is racist. Any criticism of Harry and Meghan is driven by racism. And this notion that's really come up over the past couple of weeks and past couple of days, in fact, that the nation itself is racist, and that's why we apparently couldn't take to this new royal woman, is completely and utterly untrue. And in fact, if you cast your minds back to when she first came around, there was a huge amount of positivity.
Yeah, of course.
During the wedding, there was a huge amount of positivity. 28 million people watched it. It was very positively covered on all the front pages of the newspapers. People only started to have a problem with Meghan Markle and Harry when they started to become really obnoxiously woke, very hectoring. They were flying around the world in private jets while at the same time lecturing people about their carbon footprint.
Yeah.
Meghan Markle was using the pulpit of Vogue magazine.
The pulpit is a good word. Again, this is a religion, and if they could burn you at the stake for those of us heretics who disagree with them, they would. But instead, you'll lose jobs, lose friends, might have some stones thrown through your window, or if your night's as far as you'll have eggs thrown at you.
Tell us all how we ought to be living. And people just said, hold on, we don't want our royals to dictate to us.
Right.
We want them to be symbolic. We want them to play a key role. We want them to be traditional and to tap us into history. But we don't want them to...
And we want them to be actually British, if you're British. Funny that, isn't it? The British royal family, you want that to be British.
Wag their fingers at us.
Yeah.
So that's the moment at which people said, okay, we're getting a bit tired of this Meghan Markle phenomenon. It had nothing whatsoever to do with racism. And I think that all this discussion now about how racist...
Like most things got nothing to do with racism.
Mr. Britain is actually a new form of elitism itself, because it's basically these well-connected, often well-off, chattering class types...
Hypocrites.
...looking down their noses at the nation, particularly at the kind of people who read tabloid newspapers, who they really loathe.
Well, I love the fact that
calling us all racist.
Yeah, the New York Times and the Washington Post writing about how racist Britain is. Two newspapers which are situated in two of the most ghettoized cities in the world. And I lived in New York for 10 years, and I used to go to Washington all the time. I've never seen ghettos like that in any other part of the world. And the idea that we are racist and they're not somehow is ridiculous. You know, the people who are black in America have a much more difficult time getting anywhere than the people.
Yeah, I mean, that is true, but largely, and I often say, I take no joy in saying it. I mean, the blacks kind of produce what they produce wherever they go. Black people do. And they kill their own people. And, you know, the media and Black Lives Matter, instead of preaching to us about Black Lives Matter, apparently they should tell their own people, because apparently they don't know, because they keep killing each other and they keep making the neighborhood so dangerous and uncomfortable for other people who live there. They just move out. So what you have is a phenomenon of black ghettos, and you have the same phenomenon over here a lot of the time with Muslim neighborhoods. Diversity is our strength, though, so stay focused. Keep to the narrative.
Who are ethnically related to different races in this country, because we're a very much, I mean, one of the things you notice very much about London is how mixed it is.
Yeah.
You know, when you go to...
Is what a shithole it is.
Any other country, you go to Spain, you go to France, you know, we are much more cosmopolitan and much more mixed as a population than most other cities of the world.
Absolutely right. And one of the things that concerns me most...
And you've seen the place deteriorating, even just taking it on numbers alone. If we had 300,000 or 400,000 Christians coming into this country and they were the best Christians in the world, it still wouldn't make the place that probably much better, because it's just anybody knows that a larger population just makes it more difficult for everybody. Congestion on the roads, getting doctors, getting dentists, getting your kids into schools. I mean, it's just common sense. But add to that, we're not exactly inviting, like, you know, 350,000 Christians or just white Western Europeans into the country with decent values into the country. It seems common sense to me that London is kind of not as great a city as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
It's about this idea that Britain is a racist country is that it actually grates against the possibility of greater integration.
Yeah.
Because it sends this message constantly to migrant communities or to newly arriving migrants. It says to them, listen, guys, this is a really horrible country. It's full of racist scumbags. They probably hate you and everything that you represent. So watch yourself. Be careful. And so that actually just grates against the thing that had been happening for the past few decades, which is more and more integration. And so I'm
debatable. The idea that there's been more and more integration happening in this country and in this city in recent decades is nonsense. And even if it was true, does that make it a good thing? How about everybody just sticks to their own little border? The reason we have nations that become nations, which we would say that's a Muslim nation or that's a Christian nation, is because people like to gravitate to what they're familiar with and what's comfortable, and rather than, you know, having all these different tribes and creeds and religions and peoples all lumped in together, because that has always produced wars and enmity and tensions. I mean, it's just common sense.
And you mentioned the New York Times piece that was written by Afua Hirsch, a Guardian writer, who had what can only be described as the most comfortable upper-class upbringing you could imagine.
Yeah.
Private education, Oxford, straight into the broadcast media and then into a Guardian newspaper column, who then presumes to speak for all black people in Britain. And even though her experience is completely different to other black people's experience in this country, you know, my parents are immigrants. They came from Ireland, so I am a first...
Yeah, strictly speaking, Brendan, but you know, I don't think we're really talking about Irish immigration here, buddy, but anyway, go ahead.
Generation Britain.
Right.
And the thing that I'm interested in is the question of how immigrants can integrate, feel part of the nation, and this whole depressing
I mean, I'm not completely Irish. I'm half Irish, and I was brought up in Northern Ireland, was in the UK. But if I considered myself fully Irish, I mean, at least we brought a bit of crack over here now, didn't we? And at least we built the roads over here, and you know, at least we weren't part of grooming gangs.
Tropic discussion about the country being racist actually is a barrier to greater integration, and it does a real disservice to black people in this country.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I talk to Dr. Raqib Hassan quite a lot from the Henry Jackson Society, and he's very interesting on this because he talks an awful lot about how, you know, the Labour Party in particular has this view that all people from sort of the Asian continent of Pakistan, Bangladesh and India and Sri Lanka are basically all Labour voting and basically all want to remain in the European Union. He said absolute rubbish.
True.
He said most of the guys that he hangs out with and that he knows in the Asian communities of Bedfordshire and Luton and places like that, they all want to keep immigrants out because they've been in Britain now for a long enough time to say no. We've had enough of immigration. We actually want to keep ourselves safe. We want to keep ourselves from inviting people from all over the world to just come and live here. And we want to put a stop to it. And
that's exactly 100% true. And you shouldn't be surprised. I mean, you could look at these groups and think, well, that's a bit rich, mate, isn't it? You even get the same phenomenon with the Polish people who came here in the early 2000s who feel the same way about the Romanians in 2015. You're like, what are you talking about? What the hell are you talking about? You know, it's just like you're an immigrant. But the point is, you see, it's the same phenomenon. Once people, you know, whether you're a native here and you've been established here and you're part of your heritage is here and you're part of the cultural naturally and you're an ethno-national of a country, or whether you came here in the 70s or 80s and you're now comfortable and you are more integrated, you're not going to want immigration. But of course, they don't promote this narrative because then there's two obvious questions to be asked, and there's two, the implications of this are obvious. They have to then say, okay, the original native population and still the natives today who are white, who don't want immigration, are either not racist, or these other populations who have been here a while, or these Indian populations or wherever they're from, are racist. You can't have it both ways, because that's the obvious implication of this, to promote that and to have that narrative out there. It's either you have to say, well, people generally don't like immigration into a country once they've got set up in that country because of various different reasons, including security. Or you have to say, in the West, that both the whites and the people who come here and get established, they're all racist. They'd probably go with that one. They'd probably say, oh, they weren't racist, but now they are racist. No, they wouldn't go with either of them. They'll just keep a lid on it.
Many of them voted for Brexit, and yeah, that's not the narrative that we hear or see in most of the media.
You know, one of Rakib also writes for Spiked and writes very interestingly on questions of integration, questions related to Brexit, and the fact that, you know, a third of ethnic minorities voted for Brexit, and they get completely ignored in this discussion, and it's higher.
A third's a big number, but as I say, of course they're going to get completely ignored because it doesn't fit the narrative. In fact, not only does it not fit the narrative, but it could potentially destroy the narrative because of the two obvious questions and the implications of it that I've just outlined.
Among Indian heritage immigrants, right, who were very favourable towards Brexit. So it's a very complex picture. And the thing is that
not that complex,
communities
really
integrate differently depending on the signals that society itself sends to them. So when society sends a signal like, you know, you'll do well, you will really benefit if you learn our language and take part in our traditions, then immigrants tend to integrate pretty well. But when society sends the message that this is a horrible society, it's full of racist scumbags, and life will be very difficult for you here, then people tend to say, well, what's the point of integrating? So the thing that worries me most about the Harry and Meghan discussion of the past couple of days is that it really reflects this depressing, inaccurate view of the nation as being full of prejudice, when in truth Britain is more open to immigration than many other European countries, is more open to having a mix.
It is now, but it to some extent, but it's been forced upon them. Mass immigration has always been imposed, and that's why another reason why I don't like it. Some people say, oh, you're a Christian, that's not a very Christian attitude. Well, first of all, I think mass immigration is foolish because of the implications of it and the consequences of it. And we're seeing those everywhere. I mean, all these discussions you have about immigration and all these debates that lefties have about it, and you have them with all these progressives and these immigrants welcome and all that. If it was such a simple, straightforward thing and such a good thing, we wouldn't be having the discussion. There would be nothing even remotely detrimental to talk about it. Now, of course, they'll dismiss you and say that the only reason is because you're racist. But even if you said that was a total reality and it was just racism, why do it then? Because you'd have to say that all the other countries who don't participate in mass immigration like most other countries in the world, they must be racist too. So if you say that everyone's racist, which to an extent there is some truth in that. I mean, I think largely it's just people want to be among their own thing, and largely everyone has some sort of favorability to their own race. But, you know, either way, there wouldn't even be a discussion if it was such a good thing. It was always imposed and then pushed by the media, which mass immigration required it to do to ever happen in the first place. It needed to be imposed and it needed to be pushed down people's throats through the media by the same people, largely, who want mass immigration in the first place, for it ever to occur. It was imposed. It's less imposed now because they've done so much brainwashing incrementally and perniciously with the media over the last 30, 40, 50 years, where it's much more normative now, and it's pushed in the universities more aggressively now than it used to be. But most people don't wake up some morning in the 60s in Britain and across the West and say, why don't we invite a little pile of Jamaicans here and a pile of Africans here? It was always imposed. It's foolish, and it was always imposed. And for those two reasons alone, it should have always been, if any of it should have happened, it should have been minimal immigration.
It's a community than many other European countries, and is very enlightened in those areas. And this constant defamation of Britain as a racist country is bad for the people who live here, and it's bad for the people who aspire at some point to come here.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And I mean, you talk as well about the wokeness of Harry and Meghan and this whole kind of mental health thing, which we seem to have been consumed by. You know, I remember when Prince William...
That's another thing, this whole mental health thing. I've done a video of it with Steve Gregg, the truth about psychotherapy, and you could say the truth about mental illness and what's behind that. And you know, rightly, when you get the establishment pushing that aggressively, that it's not going to be for your benefit. But alas, that's what they're pushing. It's a form of socialism and communism. It creates dependency, and it's the opposite of what we would say, sort of what Western capitalist and Christian type true capitalism talking about. And you know, what America was built on, to get everybody on antidepressants, to get everybody dependent, to get everybody living on whatever benefits they give you, and to weaken your mind and to tell you that you're fragile and you can't do anything. That's basically what they want from that. So don't be surprised they're pushing that. They don't want you being too strong.
I got married to Kate and they became the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge. She was seen very much as an outsider. Mm. You know, now she's very much not an outsider because she's actually conducted herself in the way that people would have expected her to do. Meghan Markle has come in and she's apparently kind of been the substitute mother for Harry because she started telling him that it was okay not to be okay.
Yeah.
And suddenly that's the new kind of watch phrase, isn't it? I mean, everybody's talking about how it's okay not to be okay. You can't bully anybody anymore. You can't shout at anybody. You can't be critical of anybody. You can't fat shame somebody. I mean, you hear some of the stuff you hear is quite... I mean, I literally am sort of falling about laughing half the time watching the way people are trying to describe whatever it is that's wrong with them instead of just kind of getting on with it. And I mean, again, the media totally encourages that.
But you know, that's absolutely right. And I think one of the key turning points, or one of the things that made me think, hold on, what's going on here, is when Meghan said that she had tried the stiff upper lip thing, which has traditionally been associated with royal life, and it didn't work for her, so she just fell further into that kind of let it all hang out mental health nonsense. And so what you have is just this clash of values. You have the values of the royal family, which are quite stoic and self-contained and self-driven and not self-pitying at all, even though I actually think some royal people's lives are probably quite difficult, right? They can't do normal things.
I'm sure that's the case, but, you know, there are compensations.
There are compensations. There are huge compensations. Palaces, I mean, and wealth,
and privilege. I discovered
last
week that at Frogmore Cottage alone, they have 6 people working there.
Yeah.
You know, 2 orderlies. I don't even know what an orderly does. A nanny, a housekeeper, and a couple of other people, I think, a couple of maids or something. You just think, hang on a second, you've been telling Tom Bradby about how difficult it is being, you know, a new mother. You've got a nanny. You've got a nanny every time you turn around. You know, you've got people to do everything for you. You don't have to cook. You literally don't have to do anything. And yet, you can't manage it.
I think that one of the key things that will have turned people off Meghan was when she started complaining about her life.
Yeah.
And when she said, no one asks me if I'm okay.
Right.
No one asks me, are you coping all right? And I think most ordinary people who often struggle to make ends meet or for whom life is often quite difficult will have...
I mean, listening to some essentially previously unknown nobody, mixed race girl from some ghetto shithole in wherever she was from in America, in California, complaining about, you know, life as a royal. I mean, geez, any wonder the country doesn't like her. I mean, she comes from one of the most unprivileged backgrounds, to probably the most privileged background you can get, and she's not happy, complaining about it. You know, go and get a job at McDonald's then, love.
Thought to themselves, you know, pipe down.
Yeah.
Your life is lovely. Right. You're famous. You have a cottage, which is not a cottage. It's a mansion.
Yeah, and as I say, and you're a nobody. It's not like you had some great career you carved out for yourself in some walk of life beforehand, and you've actually got any character, because the way she treated her husband was like a dog. You know, she's a total ruthless social climber. This girl divorced her husband, sent him the ring in the post after she got some acting job in some, I don't even know what it's called. No one heard of her in this country. She treats her father like crap. I mean, she hasn't got any character. She's got no real career behind her. And she's just a little scumbag. And all people can focus on is the fact, oh, isn't it great that she's a black girl into the royal family, because they're a hatred for the royal family and because they see that the royal family is evil white people. And focus on any criticism she gets is because she's black. Nothing to do with any of the other stuff. That she's a spoilt little bitch. And that she should have some sort of gratitude in her heart. To put it mildly.
And
you live in the grounds of Windsor Castle. You fly around the world in private jets. You go to Elton John's house in the south of France. Stop.
You don't have
complaining.
To pay for anything. I mean, when was the last time she had to take pay for something? You know, that trip they made to Australia, $81,000 that cost, you know, because they took so many people with them. And, you know, at any point in time, she could turn around and go, can somebody get me a cheese sandwich?
A cheese sandwich? Can somebody get me a bottle of the most expensive champagne? Can someone get me, you know, some lobster, please, or whatever. Cheese sandwich.
Absolutely right. She's worn garments which are worth more than many people earn in a year.
Yeah.
And so, you know, British people don't take kindly to people complaining, especially if they've got nothing to complain about.
Right. Well,
so
working class, real people don't.
People thought, you know, we're getting sick of this Meghan Markle show now, actually, because you actually have this very nice life and you present yourself as the victim. Mm. And it really demonstrated how entrenched victim politics has become within the chattering classes, within the liberal elite, where even a princess, even a duchess, even someone who lives in the lap of luxury could present herself as a victim and expect sympathy. And that's the moment at which it broke down.
Yeah.
And
but you see, because she's black, she is afforded victimhood status. It doesn't matter that she is a princess in one of the most famous, esteemed, wealthiest families in the world. Doesn't matter. She's black. She gets victimhood status. If you're a white guy sleeping on the street, screw you, scumbag. Go and get yourself a job.
Ordinary people said, no, we're not giving you our sympathy. And you have got to stop complaining. Mm. But she didn't.
Well, it reached kind of peak idiocy, didn't it? That famous day in the House of Commons when they were all shouting at each other and screeching at each other because Boris Johnson had said a word that they didn't like.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like ridiculous. You know,
yeah.
I've had...
Yeah, I did a video on this because Boris Johnson said, you know, said it was humbug when they started having a meltdown when he called it the surrender bill. I mean, essentially, it's just censorship. But yeah, I did a video on it. It's just you can see it on YouTube with hypocrites on the, you know, on the front of it, and Remainers have a meltdown in the Parliament.
Situations, and I'm not going to get into the detail of school scenarios, but you know, there's a situation at a school that I know where somebody got into trouble for making fun of an underage girl who got pregnant. The underage girl who got pregnant didn't get into any trouble for getting pregnant, but the person who made fun of the girl who got pregnant was the one that got punished. And you suddenly go, well, hang on, there's something slightly round the wrong way about this, isn't there? So you're okay with that, but you're going to punish that person for saying something. And this is the whole kind of thought crime stuff now that we get into, right?
Complete thought crime, speech policing, Boris Johnson saying the word humbug because a Labour MP...
YouTube deleting all your videos for what? Very good question. I mean, they always say about inciting violence and hatred towards groups, also known as like stating facts about Jews will definitely get your videos deleted. And essentially stating facts about anything that's remotely... anti-establishment. I mean, I've had about 10 videos deleted now.
The Paula Sheriff complained that his language, because he referred to the Brexit bill as the surrender bill.
That's right.
And she said, how can you use the word surrender? You're going to cause MPs to be killed. You're going to cause a rising far-right
violence. I mean, the use of the Joe Cox murder has been quite shameful.
Absolutely, completely and utterly shameful. And basically exploiting a horrific murder to score political points and exploiting a horrific murder in order to silence Boris Johnson in particular, but also other politicians too. It's the definition of cynicism. And of course, the hilarious thing...
You find as well that so many politicians now are completely and utterly wedded to this kind of bald-faced lying, which they never used to do, I don't think, as much as they do now. I mean, they did a bit of spin. We all, you know what Alistair Campbell was up to when he was in Downing Street with Tony Blair. But they now... Like Corbyn and this whole business of Trump, you know, buying the NHS.
Yeah, they just flat out lie now. They, you know, it literally is a form of psychological warfare, which scrambles any, it scrambles the brain. It scrambles the senses when you're faced with something. It's just say the complete opposite. It takes you a while to adapt to that, to be able to know how to respond to it when it's just the complete opposite, complete lies. And I do believe it comes out of this Jewish stroke satanic mindset. It's a form of psychological warfare where you just literally say the opposite of what's true. And it really does put people off balance, because it's like, you're like, it kind of takes you a moment to really kind of register and process it. It's like the human brain is largely, I believe, designed to absorb things which are true and genuine and real. And it really scrambles that when you get these political figures who literally just absolutely lie about things which are just obviously not true. But you like, it's pathological audacity and pathological lying.
Jess, you know, they knew that was a lie. They knew that it wasn't true, and yet they kept peddling it.
I do worry about politicians' relationship with the truth, yeah, and the cavalier nature in which they will say things which they themselves must know is not true. Corbyn and the NHS is a very good example. I think that was a really good example of Corbyn being completely and utterly on the back foot by that point,
yeah,
in the election campaign, because he knew he was going to lose,
yeah,
and all the polls suggested that working class areas were going to revolt against him, which, thank God, they did.
Yeah, really.
So he was desperate, and so
I think one of the most odious and difficult examples of this to swallow is the United States and Israel in the Middle East. You know, there's so much lies out there about Iran being the biggest sponsor, you know, state-sponsored terror, and, you know, Israel's, you know, a victim in the region, and we must protect Israel, when the only threat in the region is Israel and their big brother bully, the United States. I mean, it's the complete opposite of what's true and what's the reality, and yet that's how they peddle it, and it works for some people. Anyway, but it works for too many of them, so that it continues and there's enough support for it from the United States, particularly. Anyway, I'll be back next Thursday. I think, what is that, the 20th? What date is this? 16th? I don't know. It's whenever it is next Thursday. I think it's the 23rd or something. Same time, 10 p.m. till 11 p.m., 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until then, have a great week, and I will see you then. God bless.